welcome to the Managing Violence Podcast, the internet's leading free resource on violence prevention, threat assessment, personal security, and self-protection, brought to you by R2S Violence Prevention. We are hashtag for the protectors. I'm your host, Joe Saunders. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Managing Violence Podcast. My guest for this episode is going to be Melissa Muir. Now, if you've never heard of Melissa, that's probably for good reason. She is not a martial artist. She is not really even in the self-protection world. Melissa is an experienced HR executive who became an expert in threat assessment and management through having to performance manage people that demonstrate risk of violence, potentially having to part ways or fire people that have exhibited unprofessional and dangerous behaviors. And she has lots of lessons that she has learned and lessons that she has taught on how to manage that risk of violence in the workplace from a HR professional's point of view. This is a really engaging and educational conversation, and I hope you enjoy it. Without further ado, here is Melissa Muir. All right, I'm joined here on the Managing Violence Podcast by Melissa Muir. Melissa, thanks very much for taking the time to join us.
Oh my gosh, thanks for having me. I love that we can be connected across the world, literally. There's something so wonderful about that. Yeah, nice to see you, Jim.
Yes, indeed. And you and I met officially, well, face-to-face in Atlanta when we were both presenting at the Global Security Exchange Forum for ASIS International. But before that, I think I'd been on several of your webinars. You'd been on a couple of my webinars. We'd sort of crossed paths through the threat assessment community. And it was really interesting to meet you face to face. And I think the conversation that we had face to face in Atlanta sort of planted the seed for me as I need to get you on the podcast, because you've got such a unique experience compared to a lot of our other guests. And you know, I've been very fortunate to interview some really world leading experts in violence management, violence prevention, security, self-protection, all those things. But that's not you. That's not the world you come from. And yet you've somehow found yourself on a speaking circuit talking about violence prevention and threat assessment and management and all those pieces. So I think our listeners will be very interested in sort of your journey. So you have a very long and distinguished career in HR and somehow got into violence. So I'll let you tell the story. What's your career journey to this point, and how did you end up on this podcast?
Sure. And I'll preface it with, you know, I spent years like, I think they got the wrong person in the room. I'm not sure that you knew, you know, so kind of just wondering, why am I in this conversation? And what's been interesting is the longer I'm in it, the more valuable I think it is. And so it's been a fun journey and a slightly circuitous one. But I think I've been in HR a little over 25 years, and all of the pieces of it, right? Employee relations and investigations and getting people paid and all of those parts. And about, a little over 10 years ago, in my area, I worked with the federal courts, which are kind of a distinct branch on the government side, and they tend to kind of have their own practices and policies and procedures. So because they're fairly unique, I was often called in on employee relations issues. So frankly, just a glorified way of saying goodbye to people in courts all over the country. And I started wondering, why are we struggling so much in how to separate employees? And why are we, I want to say this diplomatically, why do we suck at it, right? Like, why are we so bad at it? And how do we get better at it? And then I myself ran into a very awkward situation. We were letting somebody go who was the firearms instructor and a law enforcement officer within the court system. And in an abundance of wanting to be respectful about the process, I kind of and I've said this before, kind of did it in the back alley, like alone at night, can I collect your gun safe? The U.S. Marshals Service, our security arm, got wind of it and said, what are you thinking? What are you doing? Hang on. And so we had this conversation, and they came in, and frankly, there was a lot of culture clash, and they were like, this is how you do it. And I thought, why are you telling me how to talk to people? You guys don't, right? Like, that's not what you do. And so there was this back and forth and a lot of tension. And what came from it were, I think, some of the best conversations and the introduction to the role of, you know, workplace violence and prevention. And so I got invited to attend a meeting of the Association of Threat Assessment Professionals, ATAP. And it had, there was an attorney there, and there was some great insight into the legal aspects. I am a non-practicing attorney, so I had some opinions, but also it was eye-opening. I had no idea that we had thoughts legally on, you know, responsibilities as an employer to protect our employees. And then, at least in the United States, the OSHA requirements are our vague way of getting into it, but say we have an obligation when we know of threats and we know of potential harm to employees to protect them. And that has become a really powerful thing. What's interesting is on the security side, they talk about that requirement in terms of workplace violence policies and prevention. On the HR side, we're looking at OSHA completely differently. And we're talking about people falling or slipping or people, you know, injuring themselves in more kind of traditional ways. And that matchup is not happening, I think, in the way people would like. So my long answer is, I messed up in the way I said goodbye to someone, thought that I knew what I was doing. And it started a conversation about how both of us can learn from each other and do better.
And that's a really interesting sort of opening of the conversation in terms of how we can learn from each other, because it's not just about you had to learn how to do security better or you had to learn how to manage risk better. It's actually about how both sides can take what's good from the other side and work together. Yes. Because I'm sure everyone who listens to this show would agree that, you know, like, better human interactions lead to less violence. So sometimes the security side isn't very good at the human side. They're very good at the prevention, maybe in the barriers and controls and things like that, but they're not necessarily good at the, you know, stopping the grievance from happening in the first place. We won't go into huge length about the pathway to violence and so on, all those different bits and pieces, but certainly from a HR side, you have insights that the security team won't necessarily have, and vice versa. And I think that's one of the things that, at least that I do a lot with our consulting work, is trying to get those two teams or multiple teams, not just HR and security, but other parts of an organization, to actually share information with each other, because we all have little pieces of the puzzle, especially if we're talking about the threat that a particular employee may pose or a particular customer or a particular service recipient. We all have probably got little bits and pieces of information that on its own doesn't look like much, but all together suddenly looks like a very concerning picture. So I think probably as a first question for you, what were some of the mistakes that you sort of took for granted, or things you didn't realize were mistakes, obviously, or else you wouldn't have been doing them? But yeah. What are some of the things that were sort of common practice in HR that you look back on now and go, ooh, we were really lucky that didn't go badly.
Yeah. Let's see. How much time do you have? I think I have a fairly long list. I will say, when you ask the question, the first thing that jumps out is I had no awareness. So I had no kind of understanding and framework to put the information that I had into context. And one, an early example, when we were doing benefits processing and there was an issue with an employee and security at that point asked about it, I remember stopping and I was like, well, yeah, he changed his life insurance and updated his beneficiaries and gave us a new address. That usually means somebody's going through a divorce, some financial stuff, right? And so I knew all that stuff. It had never occurred to me that that kind of information had any use whatsoever or any greater context that would be helpful. And as soon as somebody said, well, you know, is there anything happening? And I'm like, sure, there's a whole lot of things happening with that employee. Why do you care, right? Like, and once that, I think Rick Shaw talks about, collecting the dots and connecting the dots. But once those dots were connected for me, now I can never unsee those types of changes. At the same time, I don't know what you've seen with HR. What I certainly have felt personally, and I think about, is I immediately go, hold on a second, that's private. That's information that I'm not allowed to share. I can't, right? Like, I can have that, but I can't tell you that. You want to play this game of 20 questions, right? So I think when I think about learning, one is the facts, right? Like, I had a lot of information that was valuable from a workplace violence standpoint and had never thought about it that way. And then the second piece is, and I have a lot of strong feelings about why I'm not going to work with you on it, right? So those are the two biggest learning. Then I think there's lots of other pieces along the way. But for me, the biggest ones are, until I understood that I was, the expression somebody used was, HR is the canary in the coal mine, that we've got this, like, we know all these pieces here long before it gets to that. Like, we probably hired that person. We probably are working with their supervisor on the performance issues and conduct stuff that's happening. We're probably working with the union on whether we can do something, right? Like, we know all those stuff, but we don't know anything about the security world or why that's relevant.
Yeah.
Why it matters.
Or even if the security team are looking at that person for anything. I mean, there's a... Oftentimes, their silos get so entrenched that we don't even know that we're not. We don't even think to tell each other that we've got a concern.
And if you come to me without context, I am going to play into every stereotype I have about security, and I'd be like, I'm going to say no first, and not probably even listen to the reason for the question. And so, for me, I think the biggest thing that I would do if I could, like, change the world would be help my security partners help people like me understand why this matters, right? Like, that awareness is the biggest thing. Come to me with some information about, like, the FBI making prevention a reality has a wonderful checklist of things to watch for, because HR be like, well, what should I watch for? What's my, what, right? There's a checklist. These are the kinds of things. And if you look at it, a shocking number of this, the conduct, behavior, concerns that we watch out for touch HR, right? So I think before you come to me at the last minute, or I come to you at the last minute, as security would often say, with a crisis situation, it's too late at that point. Come to me with some awareness. Help me understand why that matters. And one example, I did a presentation to HR colleagues within the city about, as people were coming back to work, how we were anticipating domestic violence to show up, because that's when people are going to possibly leave an abusive partner, they're out, right? And every single, and it was kind of silent, there wasn't a lot of information, and then people started coming to me afterwards, and I realized not once had any of my HR colleagues, who are great people and tremendous professionals, made a connection between domestic violence and the pandemic policies we were working on, right? And I thought, what if security just came out and said, can I offer a little overview about domestic violence and things to watch for to our supervisors or to our HR folks, right? Like, think what that could do to establish and kind of get through those silos before we get to the crisis where I'm saying no and you're saying I hate HR, right?
Yeah.
Not that you would ever say that, Joe, right? But before the...
As long as I get paid.
I hear some pretty consistent complaints about HR. And I also want to say, what do you think people like me say about you?
Yeah. And look, I mean, it's just the nature of what you do. As you said, privacy is such a huge thing with HR. And privacy is the enemy of any investigation, right? You want as much information as possible. And if someone who's supposed to be on your side is withholding that information from you because of their obligations or ethical concerns or whatever, then that becomes a real frustration. And believe me, having worked in healthcare, where it's even tighter in terms of confidentiality, yes, and so on, there's a lot of, even when you understand the reason, it's still frustrating, because you know that if I just had that information, But yeah, anyway, before we go down that path, I'd be really interested just to backtrack into HR and talk about a little bit about, from your perspective as a HR professional, what are some of the key things early on in an employee's career? So whether it's the background checking, whether it's the interview stage, whether it's the early probation period, what are some of the flags that you look for now when you're thinking about the risk of violence or the risk, even just antisocial behavior, poor conflict management, anything that might be a flag that this person isn't going to work out or could be a risk? What are some of the things that you look for?
Sure. And again, because, you know, I say the best way to deal with a disgruntled former employee is to not hire them in the first place, right? So for me, what I have really been struck by in terms of working with security partners, and again, just to clarify, I make no pretense of being a security expert, is the consistent patterns. So within HR, I have long said, and I think this is widely held, you know, we do behavioral-based interview questions, right? Tell me about a time you dealt with a difficult project, right, or something. And so the idea is that past behavior is the best predictor of future behavior. We get that as a concept, but we're thinking about project management and we're thinking about attention to detail. We are not thinking about deception and we are not thinking about you are toxic and you are a bullying person and you're probably still going to be a bully in your next job, right? So I think that it's a concept that is deeply held in HR and not expanded to an area around the risks or workplace violence. So the second I started thinking about things like, right, it was a security professional who told me, you know, people are deceptive in their interviews and you probably want to watch for that. And all of a sudden when I started looking, and I, you know, have talked about how not to hire a psychopath, but at every level, when we start saying, oh, what are people, right? We're all perhaps putting our best light in the interview, but where is it when it goes deeper? And now it's somebody who is not who they say they are and is not, doesn't behave the way they do when they're on show in an interview. So I think for me at the front stage, that's been the most powerful, is saying, how do we bring in really into our process a look at the deception and the toxicity that are going to be downfalls to that department later when we bring that person in. And I will say that right now, at least in the US, we have a very tight labor market still. So we're watching literally our supervisors and frontline managers lower their hiring standards by the minute, right? And one of the ways they're doing it is we're rushing through at the reference check stage, which is the most important part. So I have really taken to heart, if we really want to investigate somebody before they're a problem employee, that's at the reference check stage. That's at the testing stage. That's at all those things. The one part when our supervisors are like, now I got to hire this person before someone else takes them from us. So building in more thorough vetting up front is the single biggest change I think we can make.
Yeah.
Does that help? And then if you want, I would love to go on my soapbox about performance management.
Oh, that's actually my next question. That's actually my next question.
It's a little less glamorous and sexy, but.
I just want to share with you that. So there was a fairly well publicized case where a public health department here hired a guy into a finance role. It wasn't a senior role, but it was senior enough that he had some control over the organization's finances. Okay. He, on a fairly mid-level government salary, was living a very extravagant lifestyle. Penthouse over the river and all this stuff. And his cover story for why he was able to afford this was that he was apparently Tahitian royalty and that he'd left his family in Tahiti and he wanted to make it on his own, but he had all the family inheritance, so he was able to live this lifestyle. Like, why that didn't raise massive flags, I'm not entirely sure. Anyway,
I'm like, that is kind of a shocking.
Yeah. So anyway, shockingly, I know, turns out he was embezzling money. And not only that, but he'd actually had prior fraud convictions in New Zealand prior to arriving in Australia and getting this job. And Australia and New Zealand have a pretty good relationship when it comes to sharing of information. And quite rightly, the public asked, why did you hire someone with fraud convictions into a finance role? And the excuse was he didn't disclose it on his employment application. So that's a little bit of a concern, wow. Right? So what are the chances if someone's already got a fraud conviction, they might also lie on their job application? That seems fairly high. Anyway, so evidence of deception is
And again,
neutral.
When you say it afterwards, we kind of laugh and it's funny. For that organization, that's not funny,
no,
right?
It's really
like
not.
For that public, right? That's our taxpayers supported, right? Like the ripple effects and the ramifications of that and public trust are all at stake over, I don't know, he just wasn't forthcoming about his convictions.
It's unbelievable, isn't it? But I mean, as you said, it's funny now. And it's like, well, it seems so obvious now, but I can imagine being that person who was told, just hire someone. We need someone in that role. He looks good on paper. Yeah. Give him a shot. See how he goes. He's doing the job fine. Just keep rolling. And yeah.
You know, we had one here, and it's a small example, but it had a big effect. We had a man in our grounds maintenance, kind of a frontline outside worker this summer, and was not treating his colleagues very well. And at a certain point, he was on a probationary period. We decided to let him go right before it was up, when it was going to be easier. But one of the things that came out was that his references said he'd been problematic. He made a pitch for how he'd changed. I'm going to go with, you got 20 years of references, the guy's in his 50s, and you're saying the same thing. That's not great. But the first comment was, you know, he had all the skills. We really need those. Those are hard to come by. He has a certificate. We thought it would be okay. Right? And we look the other way and we believe what we want to believe, and we're sold in a market where it's like, this person has this, I'd have to train somebody, yep. What's it worth? And we make some compromises that are devastating to an organization often, right? Like the ripple effects of having to start over and the terrible things he did to his colleagues that they kept with him, right? Like we're still paying for that. He's been gone a while now.
Yeah, and you know what you said about the labor market, it just makes this even harder. I mean, I'm talking to so many clients at the moment that are unable to recruit for even basic level roles. They just can't find people. And there's one HR professional said to me recently, it's you're now having to recruit fixer uppers. You know, like you're not getting finished products. You're getting people that might have the raw materials. That in 2 years, maybe they can do the job, but that's all we've got right now.
And I'm out there. I mean, I joke here, like, why don't we start an elementary school program to start training people up so by the time they finish high school, they'll have what we need, right? Like, I do think, though, and I credit my security partners for this, we can train these skills. We cannot train integrity. We cannot train... Like those core values are so much more important to recruit for than the certificate that I can pay for you to get, right? If you're ambitious. And I just think like we have to be careful. And that, again, I think the message to HR is if you have to compromise in your hiring, compromise in something other than a core value that the organization will suffer from without. The cost is so high. But we also reward HR on time to fill positions. And we incentivize the wrong thing sometimes. Like the faster you do it, the better you are. It's like,
That's so. Right. So let's move on to, we talked about the pre-employment and early employment. Let's move into performance management or interventions in behaviors. And how do we go about doing that as a HR professional? How do you go about managing those, firstly, with a level of empathy, I guess, for the person's position, knowing that not all toxic behavior is deliberate or intended to be so, but also minimizing risk both to the HR professional and also to the workplace as a whole, because we know that sometimes those performance management conversations is what triggers workplace violence. So talk me through that process.
And I think, again, the statistics around kind of mass acts of violence point pretty compellingly to, I didn't get the promotion, I got a poor performance evaluation, I was let go, right? Those performance related, wherever they are on the scale, are named every single time or significant portion as that trigger, right, as the one. I guess what I appreciate far more than I used to, and I credit the work with risk and security professionals, is our frontline supervisors. It's not, right, like on the insider threat where there's better data, it's not the bad apple that comes in, it's the employee that we treat poorly and develops a grievance, then they have, right? So we are turning people sometimes into the disgruntled employees. And the person often who has the most impact on that is their direct supervisor. And as we get tight and our supervisors are now hiring constantly and covering with not enough staff, the thing that we're cutting is training for them in how to do things like have a difficult conversation, right? So we have stats that the people who act out violently at any level, whether it's the high profile things we read about in the news or the lower level constant, are reacting to the way they were given bad news. And we aren't training people who are delivering that how to do that effectively, right? We aren't talking about empathy. So we cover in a poor way with like zero tolerance policies. Yuck, that's HR being risk averse and treating everybody like, let's just get rid of all of them just in case, because I don't want that liability. And now we've kicked somebody out rather than giving them the support they need. We didn't give the supervisor the training in how to have the conversation. So they waited until it was a crisis and then said, you know what, you've been a problem all along. And the person rightfully is like, nobody's ever told me that, right? So if I think the thing we could do best is look at our policies from a humanity standpoint and work closely with our supervisors and frontline managers in how to manage performance, how to talk to people, how to have difficult conversations.
I think a
lot of it would take it care of.
Yeah, I think that's such good wisdom. And I think also just that sometimes performance management, from my perspective, looking in, is that it's a lot of talking to and not a lot of listening sometimes. And if someone's performance is tanking because they've got massive family stress or they're going through a divorce or they've got huge financial pressures and so on, and the only thing that's keeping them stable in their entire life is their employment, and then that gets taken away from them, or that feels like it's being compromised, or they've thought they were shielding all their personal stress from the workplace and no one knew what they were going through, but now it's obvious that I was failing at that too. That can be that massive tipping point, that whether it's a workplace violence incident or whether it's domestic violence or whether it manifests somewhere else, it's really important that we listen to what is actually going on, or at least, and you know, this is partly culture and it's about creating the opportunity to have that conversation or an environment where people feel safe to share what they're going through. But there is so much there that isn't just about what penalties am I going to employ or what controls do I need to put in place to drive this performance higher? It's about what's going on with this human being that's resulting in this poor behavior or poor performance.
And I think on the HR side, when people helped me understand, right, I use that continuum and also the pathway to violence, but however we're looking at it, right? Like when I better understand that I'm on a continuum with you, and that these actions here can result in these actions there. Right now, most HR people, we look at it as we need to get rid of the problem because it's a risk and I face liability if I allow somebody who could potentially act out to remain in our midst. So I want them out sooner, not later, right? And I don't make any connection to what might happen down the road because of the way they left the organization. I think I'm doing the right thing for the organization. So to step back and say, help HR understand those interconnections, help HR understand how our policies can work against us when we say, if you do whatever it is, right, you're under this family stress, you're drinking, you're something else, and now you're late three times, and we have a three times and you're out policy, I don't pay any attention to the reason behind it because my policies don't incorporate listening and feeling heard, right? So I think helping us understand that we can do that and be safer, and then working with that larger group, right? Like, when you start seeing that behavior, what are you doing, right? Are you documenting them out the door, or are you listening and being heard? And we know it as human beings that there is nothing more powerful than feeling heard and seen. Yeah. And yet we don't build that into our policies and our practices. And I think for me, it's help me understand that, so the next time I update the policies, I can be thinking about that, because I'm not thinking about it. I think I'm doing the right thing. I think I'm helping keep us safe, and I might actually be generating more risk for my own organization.
Mm. Yep. Way back at the beginning of my journey into this field, and one of my instructors, Richard Dimitri, he said something on the lines of, 95% of the bad guys are actually good guys having bad days. And I think that applies in a social violence situation, yeah. But really in the prolonged workplace setting, the bad employee is often potentially a good employee who is just having a really bad set of circumstances. And not always. I mean, there's some people that just shouldn't have been hired in the first place and are never going to improve, and you need to manage that as best you can. But I think we do have to exhaust the possibilities that there's a way to turn this around, as long as we can do so in a way that doesn't increase risk. You know, if we're going to make things unsafe, then we need to make the decision. But there's a lot to that. Just to complete the circle, because we've talked about the beginning, the middle, now we're at the end. So how do we say goodbye? I love the way you say that. How do we say goodbye to people? How do we terminate people? How do we control risks around that? I mean, I would like to think there's a lot of prep work that goes into how to terminate someone, but I know that that's probably going to be a case by case thing. So like, from tell me about your experience doing this.
Well, and a wonderful man named Sean Ahrens was working with people and just updated, I think in the past week, the separation guide with some wonderful tips. So I would love to include it because it's free, it's open source, download it, use it, adapt it. For me, I think the journey, again, when I talk about my back alley separation, heavily focused on dignity and respect without the underpinnings of safety. So for me, it's been that merging of the two. I witnessed in a large department that had 18 vice presidents equivalent, the new director came in and reorganized and let 12 of them go at once. And one of the things that really struck me was he said, I did it all the right way. I followed legal advice. I followed security. He perp walked them out in front of colleagues, did not allow them to go back. And remember, these are not conduct ones. This was a reorg. Didn't allow them to go back and get their stuff. Concerned about disruptive, cut them off immediately so they had no access to anything, and then took them out the freight elevator to an Uber, and the freight elevator let out next to the garbage.
Wow.
So their last impression was that. And when I challenged, when I heard about that and followed up with some of the employees, who to this day, right, they will remember that for the rest of their lives, and they're angry, right? So did any of them act out violently? No. Did they do what they could to support the organization? Absolutely not. Would they sabotage them in a heartbeat if they had the chance? Absolutely. And when I talked to the HR director, he said, I know, I got legal advice. I talked and I tried to do it with the utmost respect.
Wow.
That's the reality gap that we're facing, right? So I think it really is thinking about it from the perspective of the employee. I think for me, I often recommend, unless there's a real high risk situation, that you do it in two parts because they shut down in the first part of it, that you be generous with soft landings. It costs the organization far less to provide extended health insurance or longer severance pay than it does to put a security measure in place of any meaningful. So thinking about it from a long-term perspective. I think the other thing that really has impressed me is, what is the message it will send to this person's colleagues? They're the ones who are going to have to take up the work when that person is gone. They're the person who might have disliked them, but now feels sympathetic or more likely worried, what about me if that person could be let go? If they had a bad day, what about me if I have a bad day? So I think the message by doing a soft landing and a more generous goodbye than many managers feel is entitled is partly what we're telling our coworkers, how we treat people.
I think it's reflective of your culture, isn't it? I mean, your culture can't end at the end of employment. If you have this, you know, if the words on the wall saying that we're family and we're inclusive and we support each other, and then until we don't need you anymore, and then we put you down the freight elevator to the garbage chute, you know, like that's that undermines everything else for everyone who's still there, doesn't it? Because it shows that it's all
and
a facade.
Everybody who's there that knows that story stopped trusting that director instantly.
Yeah.
Right. They instantly were like, now I need to be extra careful because I could be next.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also, again, I think what I hear from a lot of managers is, I'm not going to reward bad behavior. Like, somehow we've done this wrong thing. It's like, we're not talking about rewarding behavior. The expression I use, right, is we're creating an alumni relationship with this person. They are going to be connected with us forever. If something bad happens, we will all say, remember that former ex employee. So what do we want that ongoing relationship to look like?
And I love the way you talk about investing in the soft landing, in that it's cheaper than the alternative and it has so much more upside. And it actually is it's a weird parallel, because I'm doing my MBA at the moment, so I'm my head's full of all these different business case studies. And I think it was Zappos that has they actually try to convince you not to work for them, like during the training phase. Like, it's like $1,000 cash offer to quit after the first week of training. So it's like, if you get selected, you get through recruitment, you go to the training academy, and then after you've had the first week of, we do things a bit different, we're a little bit weird here, we'll pay you $1,000 to walk away now. And there's only like 2% of people actually accept the $1,000 to walk away. But what a cool initiative to be able to weed out people that are not a good cultural fit immediately, to go, you know what, let's...
And then know it and to reward them for doing it, right? Yeah. They're like, I'm glad I got out of here. But would they have done it without the $1,000? No, they would wait until some awkward situation happened and it was harder for everybody long after it had become great pains to the organization. That's brilliant.
Or they would have spent their first 3 to 6 months looking for another job and still getting paid the entire time a lot more than $1,000 for less productivity, because they're already half out the door. So what a fantastic initiative. I thought that was such a cool idea.
It's brilliant. And again, I think we underestimate the impact on those around that person. We're so focused on that person and their situation that we forget that everybody else is still there and they're coming back the next day. And especially if it's in the middle of the night, they suddenly come in, nobody will tell them anything, privacy, and have no idea what happened, and they're nervous and they fill in the gaps with made up stories, and that becomes the lore, right? And so we've created a new issue in our organization by eliminating what we thought was the issue.
Mm-hmm. All right,
I will not go on forever about this, but I have strong feelings.
Yeah. I would like to just use the last little bit of time we've got. You've been doing this fantastic series of both conversations and talks and webinars and so on with Nathan Brooks from New Zealand on how not to hire a psychopath. And I thought I might just provide a bit of a platform for you to sort of just share some of the high points about one, you know, what is psychopathic behavior, psychopathy in the workplace? How does that look like? I mean, a lot of, I think probably the listeners of this show are slightly more educated, that we're not talking about someone who's going to stab you in the shower. We're talking about someone who actually has psychopathic tendencies in terms of their social interactions or lack thereof, and what impact that has on a workplace, and how do you prevent that from happening? So I'll just sort of give you a bit of a platform to elaborate.
And let me, you know, start with a little disclaimer. I will make no pretense of being an expert on psychopathy and psychological, so I'm not going to diagnose. I will say this, and it's been just amazing to be working with Dr. Brooks, because he's got all of this research, and I get to be like, and here's how it plays out in the organization. Here's what that looks like, right? So for me, I think the big ones are, you have somebody, and again, we talk about psychopathy, but also problematic personalities, right? People on some extreme. And you're looking at somebody who is charming, who is charismatic, who is bold in their decision-making, who gets things done, right? Who, like, it doesn't look back, does it in a way, is decisive, and frightening, right? And has no compunction, no kind of human regret around harming people along the way. And one of the things we talk a lot, the reason why the focus is on how not to hire a psychopath, is once that kind of person is in the organization, they are far more sophisticated at it than you are. Highly likely, I mean, we talk a lot about it, even at the bullying stage, that the person who's on the receiving end of it, the only truly successful outcome is for them to leave the organization, not this person. So once somebody's embedded, your problems are whole. Your only real chance is up at the front end. And we have a system in most organizations that are heavily dependent on interviews, where being charming, making bold decisions, reading the room are valued extraordinarily high. So we have a system that rewards people who are on that, and we have people who are motivated to succeed in that. It's, I think, a train wreck. It's a disaster waiting to happen. So one of the things we just talk about are, how can you put more objective measures, more psychological or others testing? How can you build in some things that are not so subject to that, right? Like, Nathan was part of, I think, a really powerful study that identifying victims in seconds can identify victims. Well, think of that skill in an interview context, even remote. Like, I am reading where your weaknesses are because I am hyper-focused on them. So am I going to be immune to your charms when you figured out, right, what I'm most worried about, and you play to that? I'm going to fall for it, guaranteed. So we have to build in systems that work against our human nature, really, I guess. I was saying it, right? Like, because, and I talk to hiring managers all the time, and the one thing they say is, I read people. I have a good feel for people. It's like, no, you don't, right? Which is hard to say. So rather than say, you know, no, you don't, this person is playing to that, it's to say, let's expand our process in a way that we can trip up some of those risk factors, those red flags at the front end before they come in the door.
Yeah, there's something I would love to go down a rabbit hole about. I'm good at reading people. I have a gut feel for people. I get them straight away. Like, as soon as we get that, like, certainty that my first instinct is always correct. Like, as soon as you get down that, it becomes a level of arrogance in a way. And I feel like I just need to slap people around the face and say, "Will you be able to defend your gut feeling in a coroner's court?" Or would you rather have a process you can look back on and say, no, look, we went through all these steps. Yeah. Because you just saying, no, they're fine. I like them, or I don't like them. And I have a bad feeling about that person. Like, well, would it be nice to make that a little bit more objective? just in case, because no one likes to have to defend their instinctive, purely emotional, irrational take on someone in court. So that's... But that's
again,
reality.
You know, somebody who makes bold decisions, we value that in a lot of organizations. And psychopathy, you know, the numbers are higher at the executive level. That's right, than the average population, which makes some sense. At the same time, that's the group that we tend to do a little less due diligence on, because they're so well known. It would be insulting, right? So all of the factors are kind of coming at once. I can charm you in the first minute, and as a receiver, I tend to make my decision on hiring in the first minute. Like all of those things, I think, work against somebody who has bad intentions or, you know, is not the lovely, warm, kind-hearted person that we think they are.
We could talk for hours, Melissa. I think we're just about to run up on time, but I'm sure we'll probably end up doing this again. But look, I just want to give you a platform. Have you got anything else coming up, any events or webinars or anything you'd like to promote while we've got the opportunity?
You know, I'm super excited. ONTIC Summit in Austin is going to do some really interesting stuff in protective intelligence, which, again, I will admit are two words I don't always put together myself, but I am thrilled there's going to be a panel where they're talking about legal and HR and how we really truly build a partnership. So I'm excited about like putting some of these into action. Now, if I can get my HR colleagues to join me, that would be even better.
every journey starts with one small step, and sometimes you have to be the proverbial canary in the coal mine to show how it works. Show them that it is safe to come and join all these security and intelligence people.
I hope so. Yes, I think you're absolutely right. That is the biggest challenge, is to get over our fears of the security world.
Oh, don't worry. It's the same on the other way around. I have not yet met an honest security manager who does not feel inferior when they're talking to other departments. So there's absolutely insecurities on both sides. So the more we have these conversations, the better.
And I would ask, when we're offline, I have a question for you. Oh, and just for fun, I don't know if you can see it, but look at the snow now.
Oh, wow. Know.
It's coming down pretty darn hard.
Wow. I'm sitting here sweating, waiting to turn the air conditioning back on.
Oh, it's hard to, like, it's just amazing to think of all the different places we're in.
Yeah, spaces. Yeah. All right. Well, on that note, we might leave it there. Thank you very much, Melissa. It's been an absolute joy to talk to you again, and let's do it again soon.
Love it. Thanks so much, Joe. Take care. Bye.
You've been listening to another episode of the Managing Violence Podcast. Make sure you check out our catalog at www.violencepod.com for more interviews with the world's leading experts in violence prevention, threat assessment, and personal security. If you'd like to support the work I do on the show, please visit www.violencepod.com/support. And if you're interested in booking me or my team to provide training, workshops, or consultation on violence prevention and management, you can visit violencepod.com/training. I look forward to you joining us on the next episode of the Managing Violence Podcast. Until then, stay safe and stay dangerous.